become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/MovieGeeksUnite, Facebook at facebook.com/MovieGeeksUnited, YouTube at youtube.com/MovieGeeksUnited, or bookmark our website at MovieGeeksUnited.net. And you can also access our entire library of programs, including more than 600 filmmaker interviews, right here on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/MovieGeeksUnited. It's Movie Geeks United. Tonight we have a great show. Director John Hillcoat, his latest film Lawless comes out on DVD and Blu-ray on Tuesday, and producer Tripp Vinson, who just did the remake of Red Dawn, which is currently open in theaters this Thanksgiving weekend. And speaking of Thanksgiving weekend, it was a great time at the box office. Apparently it was a record-setting weekend.
Yeah, no, it was like the I think the best 5-day week they've ever had. It was like supposed to be the best Thanksgiving weekend ever.
Encouraging.
It makes sense. I mean, it makes sense. You have a lot of good things out there, and you have the last of the Twilight franchise. Not that it's great or anything, but as far as money goes, that everyone wants to get on that. You have one of the best James Bond films, and then you have a number of other films. Lincoln is doing very well, and you know, you have all these other things that are just like really. There's a lot to choose from, which isn't always the case. You know, Thanksgiving, you usually have like an animated film or something, but it seems like this year it's really playing to a lot of diverse age groups.
Yeah, it really is,
which is wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, you can't get kind of more different than Twilight and Lincoln and Life of Pi.
Right.
I mean, that's, yeah, it's pretty good.
Okay.
And Jerry, out of the new releases this week, you actually saw something that I read that you said it's your favorite movie
I think
so
it's
far
the best
this year.
Movie of the year. I would have to say Silver Linings Playbook is the best film of the year, hands down. While doing that 90s film thing I mentioned, O. Russell's Spanking the Monkey, Don't You Dare, Don't You Think About It Right Now, but you can later. But I think this movie marries his indie sensibilities with his mainstream gifts, and he just knocks it out of the park. So I will say this, he's made 6 films and they're all gems, but this one is incredible. This film is just unbelievably good. It may be the first really awesome romantic comedy that's not really a romantic comedy, but definitely in the second half feels that way. I don't know if there's anything wrong with it. I'd have to go back home. I definitely want to see it again. But I think Bradley Cooper, and De Niro should definitely act with Bradley Cooper from now on, because this is the second time he's done it, because I like Limitless a lot, but this is a whole different kind of film. But Bradley Cooper's just like really great playing these kind of characters. And Jennifer Lawrence, I would say she's the front runner for Best Actress. I would say she may be the only Best Actress right now.
Why did you order tea?
Because you ordered Raisin Bran.
I ordered Raisin Bran because I didn't want there to be any mistaking it for a date.
It can still be a date if you order Raisin Bran.
It's not a date. So how's your thing going? Dancing thing?
That's good. How's your restraining order?
I wouldn't actually call the restraining order my thing, but getting back with Nikki is, and I'm doing pretty well. except for a minor incident with the doctor's office.
And the so-called incident with the weight.
Yeah, that was the thing with my parents. How'd you lose your job?
I... having sex with everybody in the office.
Everybody?
I was very depressed after Tommy died. It was a lot of people.
We don't have to talk about it.
Thanks.
How many were there?
11.
Wow.
I know.
I'm not going to talk about it anymore.
Okay.
Can I ask you one more question? Were there any women?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
What was that like?
Hot.
Jesus Christ.
I see it like this. I mean, best actress is going to come down to Lawrence, Mirren, Chastain, possibly. Possibly.
Well, they say that Chastain's the best thing about Zero Dark Thirty.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
They say
so.
the movie rests on her shoulders, pretty much.
And Marion Cotillard for Rust and Bone. And
I think that's very iffy because that movie is not getting great reception.
No,
I mean,
no, you're right, Dean. You're absolutely right.
I think that's incredibly iffy. That's not like one of those.
It doesn't matter,
though.
He plays
so.
A person with a disability. They might.
It doesn't matter. There's other disability roles out there. I mean, like,
The Iron Lady was not well received as a movie, was it?
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, you have to take.
Yeah.
But you also have to take it. This has been a big.
Yeah, but that was Meryl Streep, so you knew she was going to get in
there. Well,
I mean,
do you think
well,
that.
I mean,
all right.
Mary
going,
Cotillard's about the same thing.
All right, let's go. Well, she's already. Well, both of these are Oscar winners we're talking about. But going on Meryl Streep, what about Hope Springs, though? Do you think they might, because it is the leading actress category. One of the complaints this year has been there are, and we talked about this, we touched on this, there have not been that many great leading actress performances this year.
Well, I think you're gonna see Emmanuel Riva in there in places. I mean, they're not going to have both Emmanuel Riva for Amour and Marion Cotillard for Rust and Bone in there, so it's going to be one or the other. So I think they're going to go with.
Well, I'd have
Riva.
To say this before Jennifer Lawrence, I would have said this. I would, have, and I still think this is going to happen. I think the little girl from Beasts of the Southern Wild is going to get nominated.
Yeah, she is.
I think that's a. I, you know, having if I. Back in July when I saw it, I think it's one of the most amazing and great film. I just didn't think. But now looking at the whole, you know, we've seen a bulk of the performances and we know what the future performances are going to be. I would have to put her in that category.
Absolutely.
I would be surprised if she's not.
Mm-hmm. Well,
God,
I
couldn't
that
get through
movie.
That movie.
Yeah.
I saw that movie this week. I liked it quite a bit. I thought it was quite wonderful.
Yeah.
But it took a little while. It took about 15 minutes for me to really get into
mm-hmm.
it because I had to surrender myself over to the sort of shaky cam quality of it.
Oh, of course.
Which is
no,
something,
of course.
Something that I don't normally take to. But I kind of liked it in this movie because it kind of exploded their ability to
mm-hmm.
to stay on well-footed ground. You
yeah.
know what I'm saying? I mean, most of the movie takes place on water anyway.
But yeah,
so.
I know. I think there's that. I mean, you know, I mean, I would have, you know, in a different year, I mean, I think the Spirit Awards will speak to a different, as far as actress goes, and I think all the things that we've mentioned, but there, I do think in the Indie Spirit Awards, Moonrise Kingdom will be, like, represented in every category. Now, before the fall season began, it looked like Moonrise Kingdom was going to dominate the Oscars because there was a lot of talk about that. And it's still,
yeah.
I don't know what's going to happen, you know, anything can happen. But I don't see that now because I do think this Silver Linings Playbook is like The Fighters just come out and it's just, I do think it's going to dominate the, at least the nominations.
Well, what do you think of
Keira Knightley? I mean, was it technically a good movie? I mean, was it beautiful to look at or anything? Because I don't see it getting any technical nominations.
Oh, well, I know. I'm not talking about technical. I mean, technical, I think I would imagine. Look, technical, I think the problem with technical is you have so many films that are going to be vying for that. Prometheus, The Dark Knight Rises, The Hobbit. I mean, right there. Who the hell wants? I don't want to get in that fight. Well, don't forget The Bourne Legacy. And remember, you know, there's another, you know, I actually think the you know, I say Silver Linings Playbook, but let's be very honest, I think once if the standing ovation at the Les Mis first screening is any indication, I think we're looking at Les Mis dominating the whole goddamn thing.
I think so.
I don't
think you're right.
At that. If you, Matt Zola-Sites brought up a good point. There should be a, for Les Mis, there should be screenings at a specific sing-along and non-sing-along, or else fist fights are going to break out. when I saw Chicago in Los Angeles, not a great movie, but a fun movie to watch with an audience, everyone sang along in Chicago. I mean, people sang along. I had never really experienced anything like that. And that went on to win Best Picture that year. I see Les Mis going all the way in that regard. Okay, let's get your thoughts on Lincoln, Jamie.
Well, Dean and I both have seen it now.
Okay. Yeah, we've both seen it. So
first of all, I know the answer to this because I asked it last night. But Dean's big prediction this year was Lincoln as Best Picture.
Yeah, it was.
And so now
not
after
anymore.
You've seen it.
Okay. It's not anymore. I, you know, you go first. You go first on it.
All right. Well, I mean, okay, it's not my prediction for Best Picture either. I think it'll get a lot of nominations. I don't know what it can win for outside of supporting actor, because I do think Tommy Lee Jones is the best thing in it in terms of performance.
Mm-hmm.
I was really disappointed. I mean,
you were bored.
I was attentive.
You were bored.
I was attentive throughout it, but it was dull. It was like a civics lesson to me, and made not very cinematic, which, you know, I think that the material was did not play at all to Spielberg's strengths, because I think he was so preoccupied with all that dialogue, which, mm-hmm. I mean, it's like wall to wall nothing but dialogue, that it didn't allow him to do anything else really with it, or at least not any of his specialties, which is bring out some kind of magical cinema swelling emotion from the piece. I thought it was, you know, I thought it was a perfectly respectable movie, but a really stodgy movie in a lot of ways. I think that Tommy Lee Jones is the performance that registered most to me as very human and empathetic.
How can I hold that all men are created equal when here before me stands stinking the moral carcass of the gentleman from Ohio, proof that some men are inferior, endowed by their maker with dim wits, impermeable to reason, with cold, pallid slime in their veins instead of hot red blood. You are more reptile than man, George, so low and flat that the foot of man is incapable of crushing you.
How dare you?
And I think that Daniel Day-Lewis, he did the best he could with it, but I didn't find very much variety in his performance. I thought he was really one note, and I know that that's sacrilege to say about Daniel Day-Lewis. I mean, he looked wonderful. I think he could have been wonderful, but I didn't feel like he was.
Okay.
What was that?
I don't know what the hell that was.
That was me coughing.
Sounded like a dingo getting hit by a car.
A dingo ate my baby.
Well, for me, I liked it a little bit more than you did, Jamie. I mean, I thought that Daniel Day-Lewis was actually the highlight of the movie. But I didn't feel like they... You know, there's large swaths of the movie where he's not in it, you know, and so I found myself sort of wishing he was more engaged in it.
Euclid's first common notion is this: things which are equal to the same thing are equal to each other. That's a rule of mathematical reasoning. It's true because it works, has done, and always will do. In his book, Euclid says this is self-evident. You see, there it is, even in that 2,000-year-old book of mechanical law. It is a self-evident truth that things which are equal to the same thing are equal to each other.
First of all, it begins with a lot of scenes that look strangely cheap and kind of and feel kind of phony on an acting standpoint and also just on a movie making standpoint. The movie is like strangely stagey. It's weird. It would have been better maybe as a stage play first, I think. You know. And it's real claustrophobic, which is okay because it's telling sort of a story about people who are caught up in that world, you know, and are caught up in the world of bureaucracy in some ways. But still, did it have to really feel stagey and feel sort of like, I don't know, I wasn't expecting a movie that just felt like the walls were closing in on me all the time. And I
don't
think
like stagey at all with Spielberg. Normally,
yeah.
I mean, staging
yeah.
isn't something that comes to mind with him.
No, it's very rare to have that feeling. And also, you know, like visually, I felt like just rubbing my eyes the whole time because everything was all dusty and kind of smoky and everything.
Yeah,
and
I thought it was way too dark too.
And it also kind of falls into that trick that I hate of like. You know, movies that take place in past, you know, times, you know, everything has to look rather brown or black or monochromatic or whatever.
Yeah,
is their way
like J. Edgar. Yeah.
Right. It's their way of saying, well, we'd really like to do this as a black and white movie, but, you know, because we're trying to recall black and white. You know,
it's also, and I don't think it's the case with this one, but it's also an easy way to kind of mask a lack of period detail, maybe.
You know how they
shoot certain action sequences and the camera's jerking all over the place,
mm-hmm.
but,
uh-huh.
and that really masks like half-ass choreography,
mm-hmm.
fight choreography. You could do a
yeah,
lot
sure.
with that. Let the camera do the work. Yeah, it's the same
yeah.
thing with obscuring, with the dark and the mist and the smoke and the all that kind
uh-huh.
of stuff.
Yeah, and but those kind of things help. And I can understand also what Jamie is saying about the one note kind of portrayal of, which I don't think it's one note.
I don't think at all.
But I can see what you're saying because he kind of he's not a blustery kind of person, you know, that this character that he's created. He's not blustery. He's not overtly dramatic. And that's kind of a surprise, you know. I like that though. But it does.
Well,
I just thought it gave him
so few moments. And the other thing that the movie has to worry about is its whitewashing of Lincoln. I mean, no pun intended. I mean, Lincoln thought that whites were far superior to blacks. I mean, it whitewashes a lot of the history of Lincoln. I mean, his views on racial equality were evolving towards the end of his life, towards this period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But he still thought that this slavery should be banned because it was a question of law, not a question of morality.
That's an interesting fact that they didn't bring up in the movie. You know?
He didn't even
that
want
might...
blacks to fight in the Civil War at first. And then he realized,
yeah.
you know, this might be the only way to get a foothold in here and then he wanted to send blacks outside of the country once they did abolish slavery. And so there's a lot of shit in there that's you can't put in there because he has to be the noble gleaming
right
guy.
Right. I understand that. I understand. I only have one problem with the movie, and that's where it ends. I would have ended it when he's going down the stairs. Because I felt that
yeah.
that would have been the perfect bookend to the film. I was talking about this with someone the other day. Because then when you get, you know, this is one of Spielberg's, this is Spielberg's one major flaw. He doesn't know when the hell to end the movie. He really doesn't. But I didn't let it, like, that tarnish what I thought was a really good period piece. And, you know, I could see where you could see it comes off like a stage play, sort of, or where you feel the walls are coming in. But I never got that. And I like the fact that he doesn't portray him as a god. He doesn't portray him in this, like, he portrays him. What movie have you seen where a president is this, you know, anyone can pretty much go talk to him. He is not, you know, put on this pedestal, but he's actually really brought down to the people. I mean, he interacts with everyone. He's not really vaulted as God.
I love that part of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that to me was very revealing. This movie has a lot of parallels to today, whether it wants to admit it or not. I know Kushner was definitely thinking about today with the Tea Party and with the rapid partisanship in this country. I mean, that's really what I think the movie is about today. I couldn't get over that watching the trailer, just how current it is. And while watching it, how current it is.
It's definitely a movie that's not about, you know, the slavery question. It's really about the question of being able to compromise and work together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is about that. I mean,
you know,
big time.
That's really the matter. And I like that they concentrated on that.
Yeah.
And not just on the slavery question and not a lot of scenes with, you know, misty-eyed, you know, slaves standing around, you know.
Well, they concentrated on how you have to cajole and bribe to get something passed.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that's just what works. I mean,
and I knew that the movie would be about that before I walked in, so the movie didn't offer me anything beyond that, really. Mm-hmm. So, you know, okay, it's a world I know today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, dramatize something that feels fresh to me, and it was like I was watching, seriously, like a stage play civics lesson, and I just didn't think, I mean, it has prestige written all over it, and it's dusty, I mean, the thing
right,
is
right.
Mothballs, this movie.
I think its main problems are loaded in its first hour, because it takes a little while to get going, and you kind of have to surrender yourself over to sort of an antiquated way of speaking that they have in it, which I think is commendable. I mean, I think that they really researched the way people spoke and, you know, through people's letters and so forth. I think that it takes a while to sort of give yourself over to that. Once you've been in the movie for maybe about 45 minutes, you kind of get into its rhythm, and actually I think that Spielberg does do a good job of creating some kind of suspense as to how it's going to turn out, especially considering that we know how it turns out anyway. So I do think there's a level of suspense that's successfully achieved. I just wish that the first half of it would have gotten its mojo on a little bit quicker.
After the first half, there are about four moments that I liked.
Mm-hmm.
That I thought were pretty potent in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I love that scene with him and Mary Todd having the argument in their bedroom.
Yeah.
I thought that was a very good scene.
Yeah, that's one of them. When he slaps his son is another one, and then several moments with Tommy Lee Jones I thought were great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It is going to get a lot of Oscar nominations, no question about it. And I think you have to look at, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis as the front runner for Best Actor. I mean, it's not going to be the only one that comes close. Is really Joaquin Phoenix for The Master, and that's not going to win.
Well, I mean, there's that. Don't rule out Bradley Cooper, but don't rule out John Hawkes for The Sessions.
That's a movie that's kind of failing, though.
I almost walked out. Not because it's a bad movie. I found it very uncomfortable to watch. But don't rule him. I would not rule out John Hawkes.
He's definitely going to get in there.
I mean,
and Denzel Washington, of course.
I think Denzel Washington is going to get it. I mean, there's all those,
really,
but
you only got one slot that's left open after you consider Washington, Hawks, Lewis, and Phoenix, and that's either going to go to Cooper or Jackman, one of those two guys.
Oh, a Jackman, yeah. Or now, what about now? What are they going to put Russell Crowe though for Les Mis?
That's a supporting role.
That is a supporting role. Okay, all right.
Almost okay. Everything else.
Let me throw out a dark horse. Brad Pitt for Killing Them Softly.
Not going to happen.
You don't think so? Okay. Because
if it didn't happen, I don't know. That movie's getting absolutely no. There's like no air around that movie. It's just like nobody's talking about it.
Well, Harvey postponed it by a good month because he thinks it has Oscar. He thinks that's
think
an
so.
Oscar contender. Remember, it was supposed to come
so.
Out October 19th, and it did
yeah.
not.
I don't think it's going to
happen. And
it's
also
Bill
Murray. Do not rule Hyde Park on the Hudson. That's not. I would not rule that out.
That's getting terrible reviews, though.
But what about him, though?
So, It's not an Oscar role. It's not.
Okay. All right.
It's like it's rather. You know, it's like stunt casting, really. And you know, I mean, that's really all it is. He's nice in it. It's fine, but it's not a movie that people are gonna. I don't think they're gonna.
However,
it's not gonna
I do hear
take those other guys.
I do hear that De Niro's. This is one of his best in years.
Oh,
Silver
it is.
Linings.
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
Yeah. That'll be all nice.
Right. Let me throw out another dark horse. The Life of Pi. Guy's never acted before. They love that.
Yeah.
That's a
I don't know.
Strong
I mean,
possibility.
I think that movie is going to be something that, like, walks away with maybe special effects, and that's it, you know. I mean, like, nomination-wise, it's going to get, like, 5 or 6. But I think, you know, I don't think that it has a chance in any of those. Like, you know, there's a common criticism of, did you see Life of Pi this weekend?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, the common criticism that I've, you know, just gotten through the ether is that, you know, it's kind of, it only gets going when, you know, he's out on the water, but when he's, all the rest of it's not really that good. Is that the case?
No. Where are you getting these things from? And if you
common,
are getting them from the internet,
criticism.
Turn it off. Turn off
yeah.
the computer.
It's just the common criticism.
It is.
Happening.
I don't, I mean...
I mean, I'm A.O. Scott from the New York Times. He's the only critic that I read.
Okay, I read him here and you know now and then, but I'm just never really that drawn to anything anymore from them for some reason. But I don't. If you like the book, you like the movie. But here's the thing: this is a family film, and it's packed with families. But it's a family film. It's not an insulting family film. But no, it's actually fascinating. I don't remember. There's a lot of religious symbolism, and I'm wondering if that's what Devin Faraci had a problem with it, because like reading his stuff on Twitter.
Well, yeah, good old
no,
Devin.
No, but I mean,
good old Devin who tweeted, "Anyone that doesn't like Lincoln is a heathen and a movie hater." I love like these bold statements
mm-hmm.
like that.
Yeah, no, I saw that. I saw your interchange. Now, it's a good movie. I'm just curious to see where that it is. You got to hand it to Ang Lee though. He's another one that just can seem to do no wrong. Take any genre and run with it. I think it's a really good movie, and it's definitely worthwhile. Definitely go see it in 3D. I don't say that always about these things, but it's definitely there's some.
Hell,
really,
even Roger Ebert says go see it in
3D. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's definitely worthwhile. I would not be surprised. I don't know the actor's name. I actually see Irfan Khan finally getting a nomination for supporting, who plays the adult version of the main character.
Mm-hmm.
I do see that happening. It's a good movie.
Is it religious? Is it non-religious? Or does it try to toe the line between both?
Well, it's talking about how all these events happen, how he found, because the main character, in when he's growing up, and the flashbacks we see before we get to the water, you know, he's very interested. He wants to believe in everything. Every religion. His father said a man who believes in everything is a man who ultimately believes in nothing. And he adopts all these things, but it talks about how he does believe in some higher power and a God, after, you know, with everything that he's going through and everything. So it's not really just like something like Passion of the Christ or something. No. It's not something that's going to be a Bible Belt or anything like that. It's much more global than that, much more interesting than that.
Yeah, because a Christian Science Monitor, I think it was them, they ran a review that basically said that the movie was sacrilege.
Well, you're going to get that. I mean, and that's...
And then some people view it as extremely religious and spiritual.
I think spiritual may be the better word to use here, I think.
Okay, interesting. I saw Magic Mike.
Well, there we go. Speaking of a religious experience, what did you think of that?
What did you think of that?
I thought it was more spiritual, Magic Mike. It was a fun movie.
It was, wasn't it?
I liked it. It was all in the way it was directed too. I think that made it very unique. He has a way of those scenes unfold like improvisations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just the conversations. They're not staged movie scenes. It feels like you're eavesdropping a lot of times on behavior.
Right. Yeah, makes it very lively. You know?
Yeah.
But there's another guy, Channing Tatum and Matthew McConaughey, who both had great ears. I mean, really had both of them.
Well, I think Matthew McConaughey has a great shot at supporting this year.
It's funny. He's kind of dropped off, you know, in terms of people, you know, getting behind his being nominated because, you know, you've got that's a pretty packed field.
Oh, it always is.
De Niro, Hoffman, Tommy Lee Jones. You know those three are going to get in there, and then, so you only got two more spaces. And unfortunately, it seems like McConaughey has been left off.
I think he's starting to campaign for it now, and that matched with his stunning kind of weight loss for his next movie, and the fact that he's had the best single year for an actor, and the fact that it's a big comeback from romantic rom-coms and that kind of bullshit. I think he's got a lot in his favor.
Yeah, I mean, we've got possibly Russell Crowe for Les Mis, but we also now, here's the other thing. You got Leonardo DiCaprio possibly for Django.
Yeah.
I wouldn't roll that out, or any of those.
Some people are saying Samuel L. Jackson is really good in Django, too.
Yeah, I mean,
then,
he could be.
And then also in Les Mis, you have Eddie Redmayne, who's also getting pretty good reviews. So, but I mean, you know, McConaughey's still in the running, I would think, and I think he's going to get in there. But it's funny; it's just funny how people have sort of some of the Oscar prognosticators have sort of you know, backed away from talking, having him in their top, you know,
I also saw a movie called Lay the Favorite, which is the new Stephen Frears
movie. Oh yeah,
that's
on demand.
Yeah,
how is
Bruce
it?
Willis. It's got a great cast: Bruce Willis, Vince Vaughn, Catherine Zeta-Jones, Rebecca Hall.
Mm-hmm.
It's so bland. I mean, it's like,
what is it about again?
The movie has no pulse whatsoever. Bookmakers in Vegas.
Oh, okay.
But the best thing about it is Rebecca Hall. She is phenomenal. I mean, she creates a very specific character. Everyone else in the movie, you're like, they might as well not be in the movie. You don't really know whether or not they know why they're in the movie. You know, it looks like a very kind of quickie, non-vivid kind of enterprise for Stephen Frears. So, but the one thing, the best thing that I saw this past week was 56 Up,
which is the
latest in the Michael Apted documentary series, following the group of adults 56 years old who they first started following back when they were 7 and revisited every 7 years since. Those are always terrific, and this is no exception. It's wonderful. So,
yeah. I would expect nothing less from that series. So
no, it's a great series.
That's always going to be great to go back to and everything, you know, as long as Michael Apted stays with us. I watched, it was a week of documentaries for me. I watched The Imposter.
How is that?
I liked quite a bit. You know, the subject matter is, of course, this kid who is claiming to be claiming to belong to a family that lost a child a long time ago, and to the child just disappeared, and he's this French Spanish kid or whatever. This French kid pops up in Spain, and assumes the missing kid's identity and goes back to live with the family in Texas. And so you think the movie is just about this deception that this guy has created. But then it becomes something quite different where the focus is on the family and actually what happened to the original kid. So I like that. I like that it kind of switched things up a little bit. I got a little annoyed just looking at that guy's face for a little while.
It's an interesting documentary because it's filled with unreliable narrators.
Yes.
Yeah,
you can't trust anybody. When somebody finally comes in that seems like they have some kind of authority and that you can trust them, it's like, wow, finally a sane person is coming in to take a look at this thing.
Yeah.
Because you think there's just this untethered world of fantasy that everybody's living in the film. And then I saw The Queen of Versailles.
Oh, that's the best documentary of the year.
I really liked it a lot. And it's funny, I had a little sort of back and forth with Mark Johnson of Award Circuit, who I felt that he didn't get it at all because I think that he thought that they were trying to create some sort of sense of sympathy for these extremely rich people that
have hit
a bump in the road. I don't know how you would get that from that movie because I don't think that it tries to do it at all. I do think that the movie does something surprising, though, which it does humanize them. It doesn't make them into ridiculous monsters. I mean, even the timeshare magnet that's the center of the film.
But he did that only a couple of months ago.
The patriarch, you know.
He made him jackass of himself when he said, if you vote for Obama, you're all going to get fired.
Right, right. Exactly.
And then he realized the error of his ways, and he gave them all raises when Obama was elected.
it's a fascinating film. Where they go to the Walmart to buy the toys.
Even as they're like going down the drain, she can't stop herself, you know. And
oh, I know. I mean,
there's a huge train of trolleys coming out filled with toys.
You want to say to her, wait, you guys are going broke, but that does not mean you go to the discount store and buy the whole toy department.
You know, it's funny, too. One of the interesting things I got out of the movie, too, was which I never thought about this before, ever. But if you live in that kind of opulence, most of the time, it must be very difficult to go and visit, they have her living in this huge house, which is really not as huge as the one that they're building.
I know. I still can't wrap my head around that, but yeah.
But it's still massive. They have her going to visit her best friend, who just has a normal-sized house and everything. I thought, boy, that must be really weird for people who are used to living in mansions to, go and visit with somebody that's got a tiny house. It must feel like, I don't want to sit anywhere here. Everything looks dirty and everything.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And I never really thought about how extreme wealth like that, must affect people's perception of the world in that way, So I thought that was an interesting, side thing. But I thought it was a really complex little movie, and I really liked it a lot.
Yeah. I really thought it was one of the, if you wanted to understand what this year was about politically and socially and economically, that was the film to watch. I think it said so much. Although that scene where he says, I probably helped Bush get elected illegally.
That's weird.
There's another documentary, that pretty high-profile documentary, but that premiered on network television on Thanksgiving night. Spike Lee's The Making of Michael Jackson's Bad.
Oh.
Bad 25, right.
Yeah, it was aired on ABC. in a 90-minute version with commercial breaks. So we're talking probably, I mean, there are a lot of commercial breaks, probably 75 minutes, 75 to 80 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
The original documentary is 2 hours and 9 minutes. So they cut out like 40, 45, 49 minutes of the damn thing to air it on television.
Wow.
And they,
what,
and they
what
broke.
Point?
They broke at the worst places for commercials. I mean, there'd be a build up to a song, and then they'd break for a commercial.
Oh, God, that's awful.
That's bad.
But it had such delicious kind of stuff in it, you
mm-hmm.
know, and it's Spike Lee. The thing got raves. I think it premiered at Venice or something earlier in the year, and people were raving about it. And it's got great stuff. The best stuff, the most illuminating stuff, with Scorsese and Thelma Schoonmaker were sitting side by side at the editing bay watching the short film Bad. And and Spike Lee was there asking them questions, and they were giving anecdotes along the way. I mean, that was a really interesting series of scenes from it.
Yeah, that sounds great.
But you really, it just brings home how immensely talented and screwed up he was. But you can't take away that talent. Just like, you know, I was watching a documentary on Jerry Lewis the other week. I was telling
mm-hmm.
you, Jerry.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh God, this man was a genius. You know. It was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Our first guest, his new film is called Lawless, and he had to take that name from Terrence Malick's new movie that he's shooting, believe it or not. And I guess Terrence Malick gave it up. So.
Wow.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. John Hillcoat,
yeah.
Director, Proposition, The Road, and his new film Lawless, which is a great combination between a gangster film and a Western. Shia LaBeouf, Tom Hardy, Jessica Chastain, Guy Pearce, great, great villainous performance.
No,
Guy
it's
Pearce.
A good movie. It's a good movie. I like it.
Gary Oldman, it's like one of the great casts of the year. The movie's available on DVD and Blu-ray this coming Tuesday. Here is John.
There's a new special deputy. He's been brought in from the city to help us out, you know, make sure things go smooth.
What things might they be? Sorry, something to amuse you.
My name is Charlie Riggs. I'm from Chicago.
Pete, who the hell is this son of a bitch?
Me? I'm the one who's going to make your life real difficult from now on if you don't toe the line, country boy.
Won't you ever touch me again?
The first thing that struck me about the movie was that it seems to be it's a very unique blend of Western and gangster genre. Was that a big draw for you initially?
Yes, I love, those are my two favorite genres, and I was looking for a gangster film and couldn't find something new in that world, so when I came, you know, I was also separately looking to do an American Western, and yeah, absolutely, that. Then when this rolled up, it was like, well, it's when the West ends and the gangster begins.
Mm-hmm. And the author of this source material, he's a descendant of these brothers, isn't he?
That's correct. Yes.
Yeah.
His grandson, his great uncle was Forrest. And his grandfather was Jack.
When you adapt a great book such as this one, tell me about the dynamic of definitely wanting to pay honor to the spirit of that book, but you know, obviously you have to make some changes because it's a different format. Is that a difficult balance to achieve?
Yes, I mean I certainly had that. Very highlighted during the road experience, but
mm-hmm.
the one great thing I rephrase that. He said everything he said was great. But one of the things that was the most helpful was how he understood that they were completely different mediums and, you know, they shouldn't be mutually exclusive. there's no reason to that some books are harder to adapt than others. But I think you just, I think you even said, I think the key that makes it so special is what the key to maintain is the spirit of the piece, as opposed to getting bogged down with and confusing the differences between the innate differences between each medium.
Yeah.
So, in other words, you let the poetry of words do their thing, and what you're looking at is how do you physicalize the characters and that world that's on that page, and what the spirit of the book is trying to convey. And I do think that is possible.
Yeah.
Or at least I hope.
I think it works beautifully. Tell me about, because years ago this project was set up, and it was a different cast outside of Shia, I believe. Were you on board at that stage, the earliest stage?
Right from the get-go. I had seen at first I was approached by producers at Red Wagon with doing a Sony movie, my first studio film, with the book. And I loved the book. And I took the book to Nick Cave. And then, Shia was an actor that I had my eyes on since Guide to Recognizing Your Saints, because I could see a real actor lurking underneath. And then he got swept up in all those franchise films. And when I met him, he couldn't sit still. And he, I think with all actors, there needs to be an element of something about them that relates to that character. So there was this kind of restlessness and enthusiasm that Shia had that really suited Jack.
Mm-hmm.
And then we built it from there. This was, it was 2008, and then the economic meltdown came, and Sony announced that they couldn't make films like this anymore. We had to go back. We had a fantastic cast back then. And then, as time went on, we had to hit the reset button and put it together again when the opportunity arose.
Right. But I understand this is, I understand it, it was an incredibly fast shoot. And I'm curious to know if that speed, if there's any benefit for you in working fast like that.
Well, I always work fast, actually, believe it or not. I mean, the movies take a long time, but that's often due to the politics of post-production, as opposed to the shoot. I like to try and get things. I like to have I like to get an energy on set where there really is, it doesn't get bogged down. This was an energy that, it certainly forces everyone to keep focused and put a lot of pressure on, and sometimes that can be a good thing. People either rise to the occasion and often step up beyond the call of duty and do remarkable things in that process, or it can go the other way. And I was very fortunate that everyone, we've got such a great cast. And really it was, the fact that our cast, I think rehearsal is critical to at least have those conversations at the very least that you don't have time to have on set. together, and we were all, I think shooting on location helped, because it's almost like enforced method. Everyone sees and feels the world that we're in, and therefore that helps inspire people to, you know, reach that goal that we're trying to get to. So there's pros and cons. I mean, the action stuff is probably where it isn't helpful. In fact, it's definitely not helpful when it comes to action, because you can't rush that stuff. It takes a lot of choreography. Safety is paramount. You have special effects that are very time consuming. That's the painful bit. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense, yeah. And I understood that, you know, the finale, the big action climax of your film, was you only had a little over 3 days to shoot that?
That's right, 3.5 days. That nearly killed us. I mean, the cameraman at that point, Benoit Delon, who shot the proposition, fell asleep standing up. that's how exhausting it was. So I did promise everyone that I would never put them through that again.
Yeah.
Here it is. As long as you are my brother, you will never let this happen again. Do you understand? I don't think you do. What if I can't? I'm not built like you, and I ain't never been like you.
It's all right.
Jack, it is not the violence that sets man apart. All right, it is the distance that he is prepared to go. Jack, look at me. We are survivors. We control fear. And without the fear, we are all as good as dead.
I wanted to ask you about two performances in particular, in terms of setting the right tone. Because when I was watching Tom Hardy's performance in the film, I recall the anecdote that Dennis Hopper told when he was directing Robert Duvall. He was behind the camera directing him, and he said, "No, you've got to do more. You're not doing anything." And Duvall knew that, you know, when you see that on the screen, it's going to read, I am doing something. You just don't see it right now. And Tom Hardy's performance is so minimalist in this film. And I wanted to know about getting the tone of that right, so that you were for sure that it was reading on camera, as opposed to something like Guy Pearce, which that role could have easily been an over-the-top mustache-twirling villain.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and they are polar opposites in terms of, you know, who their characters are and how they behave. Actually, I had the opposite experience where, making the proposition to Danny Houston, I was saying, you've got to, you know, do less. And when I showed, and I showed, Danny's a very smart man, and I showed him the rushes of when he was in the cave area and all these flies buzzing around him, and I explained, it's also, on that big screen, when he saw it, he instantly got it, and that changed his whole performance from there on in. So I totally get that and respect that, and I'm always trying to strike that balance. With Tom, you know, with particularly that role of Forrest, these guys, you know, found it very hard to articulate their feelings, their emotions. You know, it was a different age, different place, and these were hard-bitten guys, and he so we talked a lot about that, about how that internalization and the stillness and the kind of art and understood it in a way that even way beyond even me. And there were moments where even I was kind of concerned about how far he was taking it. But then in the edit, I could see how brilliant that was. He also reduced the language to just mumble grunt in a way, that wasn't really ever on the script, much to Nick's initial dismay. But he was so expressive about it that it said more than actually those particular words did. But there's also a vulnerability that he brought with the cardigan and the kind of mother hen. Incredible internalization thing. The rehearsal process was critical when we were discussing the characters. Nick Cave was with us. We were in the middle of remote Georgia, actually in a school, a sort of religious school that we overtook as our offices. I actually talked about Jimmy Cagney, the way that no matter how big he was always truthful.
Mm-hmm.
And we looked at people like Capone, like documentary footage of those guys from that era, and they were like Cagney. They really were these flamboyant, larger-than-life, gregarious guys who were street thugs that were given all this power. Now, in Guy's case, he was also trained, but so thoroughly corrupted and so vain. So it was really just discussing the essence of each character, and then they have their different approaches. I mean, for a guy, in fact, the way he works is from the outside in.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very important, the hair. He did the radical step of sending us a photo of him without eyebrows,
mm-hmm.
which was, this was all came out of the extremity of the character. This guy didn't like to be touched. He was very anal. He would wear gloves. He hated the idea of being in the country. It was vulgar and full of smells and texture that he didn't. He loved his suit. He would wear this stuff like armor. And he was so kind of vain that he had lost all empathy for other people. And a lot of these sort of guys we analyze, those sort of sociopaths that don't, can't relate or feel what other people are feeling. And the extra brutality that they go to, and the pent up frustration that he has with trying, being this control freak and having all this power and being so corrupted, you're unleashing someone quite scary.
Yeah.
So it was all grounding it. I think the key in both cases was ground it in a reality of who that character was from those times. For Tom, it was a very internalized process with some external work. And for Guy, it was very much this kind of embodiment from the outside in.
Wow. It's a terrific movie and terrific performances, and I love all your movies, and I really appreciate you giving me time to talk about it today.
Thank you. I mean, all these people, at different times, there was tonal range that I was very enthusiastic to explore, the humor and other aspects, vulnerability, etc. So I appreciate that you picked all that up because some people haven't.
Okay, that was John Hillcoat, the movie Lawless. available on DVD and Blu-ray November 27th. That's Tuesday. Pick it up. Highly recommended. Okay, here's some emails.
Oh, shit.
Do we have our email music?
It's mail time!
Go.
Just like in Magic Mike, it's a mail review.
It just says, you know, letters flying through the air.
That's exactly what it says. And Pac-Man eating them. Yeah.
Yes.
Here's Sven from Norway. I have a theme I would like to hear you three discuss. What's in a name? I was thinking about Lincoln. What I've heard about this movie is that it's about the 13th Amendment a lot more than it is a standard biopic. Is it right to call the movie Lincoln? And another name, The Godfather 3, which was originally in Coppola's desire, was to call it The Death of Michael Corleone. I believe that title would have been better, and people's perception of the movie, essentially is what he's saying, would have been much improved if it had been called The Death of Michael Corleone.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what we call a spoiler?
Yeah,
I remember that, yeah. I mean, that's interesting. I mean, I wonder, though, when you call it something like that, I mean, and you sort of know in a movie like that, that's a definite possibility. It's just how it's going to happen. There are many different ways they're going to do that with Michael, but you sort of know that's coming down the pipe there. It could have, Lincoln's not, I mean, that's an interesting point, but I guess to sell it, I guess.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a marketing tool. It's just a way. I see what he's saying in the sense that, you know, if you're going to call your movie Lincoln, or if you're going to call it Ray, or if you're going to call it, you know, Hitchcock or whatever, your mind automatically goes to something that's going to be the definitive kind of biopic, and it has to fall into that biopic kind of shape. You
know?
I
don't think the passing of the 13th Amendment would have been a really gripping title.
yeah,
the Raiders of Raiders of the 13th Amendment.
Although
so
Team of Rivals, Team of Rivals wouldn't have been a bad.
I'm curious
to
go with that. That's interesting, but no, it's an interesting point, and like, you know, Hitchcock, you could have called it Shower Time. I don't know.
Well, there's also, you know, bad movie titles you can think of. What was the one that we talked about last time, Dean, and you were like, what was that movie?
That's right. It was All You Need Is Kill.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's it, yeah, yeah.
And it still makes me laugh when I say it. All You Need Is... It's like somebody who didn't know how to write English just wrote that.
Exactly, yes. I need kill.
I need kill now.
This was the original title of Amistad. Give me my free, or give me free, or whatever it was.
Yeah.
It's like,
now,
yeah.
Willard's give really me bad free. Trip.
That's funny.
I mean,
yeah,
The Shawshank wasn't a barn. The Shawshank Redemption wasn't a barn burner of a title. I remember John Malkovich talking about, you know, his reaction to reading the script of being John Malkovich, and he's like, well, you know, I knew right away that the title, you know, wouldn't bring him out in droves. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, a name, yeah, a lot of times the name is the toughest thing to come up with.
Right,
some
no, you're absolutely
one.
Right.
I hate those titles. Well, first of all, I get really irritated with titles that take titles from other movies. Like, for instance, you know, didn't Safe come out this year with what's his name in it?
With Jason Statham, and you were thinking of Julianne Moore movie, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Or,
yeah.
Why can't you come up with another title? It's already been done, you know. There's 1,000 words out there, 1,000,000,000 words out there. It would be very easy just to come up with something else.
This is from Joseph, our good buddy Joseph, who wants to chime in. You know, I'm getting like, I have a lot of people writing me lately and saying, you're dead wrong. This is the
well, it's all over Lincoln, so, I mean, now you know what I went through with Hugo.
Joseph says, I just listened to your show from the 12th, and I've been thinking about your discussion on the status of women actors. It seems to me that the original emailer, Owen, and I were making different points. Owen was saying that proportionally, women are more accomplished and better actors than men, while you were saying that men have been given the more legendary or groundbreaking performances. I'm not sure exactly what your criteria is. Whether you mean iconic performances or great performances or some mixture of the two. I remember a few years ago this argument came up on your show, and Chris made my argument a lot more pointedly, according to Joseph. He says that Chris said people are just more interested in men and that they should have that they should be. That sounds like Chris.
Probably not far from the truth, really.
Yeah, he says, now it's possible, though I haven't tried mentally scoring the sexes, that men have had the better showing since the 70s. But if you take in movies before that, you can come up with great actresses and performances to match all the men that you and Chris mentioned.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I agree. That's where I think the blinders are on in your argument, Jimmy, when you look at the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, that was dominated by women. Those were dominated by women.
Joan Crawford, Betty Davis, Katherine Hepburn, Judy Holliday, Elizabeth Taylor, Audrey Hepburn, Marilyn Monroe, leading up to the 70s with Faye Dunaway. I never said that there weren't great female actresses, and I just said that if you list the classic film performances, you'll get a lot more men than you will women. I mean, that's all I said.
I think
it depends on who's making the list.
Yeah,
You don't say Marlon Brando changed acting forever. Well, it depends on who you're reading, who's writing about acting. It's generally accepted Marlon Brando changed screen acting. And before that, there were hints of it with James Dean and Montgomery Clift. But Marlon Brando was the benchmark.
They were all learning acting from, Stella Adler and so forth. So,
Marlon Brando had it in him to change acting.
He was given the opportunities. Yeah, he was.
He made the opportunity. He didn't have to play on the waterfront like that. It could have been played traditionally like anyone else would have.
I want to chime in something here just about that. I think there's a lot of great actress performances every year. I think some years we had one year where we had Kate Winslet, Penelope Cruz, Meryl Streep, Helen Mirren, and Kate Blanchett all in the Best Actress category. This was in 2006 for their performances. All very good, really good performances. And a lot of great, we do talk on the show a lot about actresses and great actress performances, especially from recent years. But there's one director forgive me, Jamie, is Jane Campion and the performances she brings out in women that are truly astounding. One of them, the actress doesn't really say much in the movie. That's Holly Hunter in the piano. But she does have this way. I was just thinking that, or something like Bright Star, what's the actress in Bright Star who was
Betty
very...
Betty Cordish. And then,
she was
and then
her.
There's that.
I mean, and she's good in a lot
there's
of...
Also... There's also Carrie Fox and Angel at My Table.
Yeah, Angel at My Table and Sweetie, and there's the piano. Even something, at least she tries to do, give Meg Ryan something different to do in the cut. And then there's the one with Kate Winslet, Holy Smoke. I mean, there are a lot of great actress performances. We do talk about them on the show, and there just are. I guess it just depends who's making the list, you could say, or who's...
I can list all the great female performances, but... I can list a lot of them.
Yeah, no, and I'm not saying I'm not making the argument that you can. I don't know where that came from. I don't know where that whole argument came from that you wouldn't.
Look, this is just basic. I mean, tell me if I'm wrong here, okay? Tell me if I'm wrong. But this is an extremely male-oriented show. This is an extremely male-oriented show. Am I right or wrong?
Well, unless I don't know something about the two of you.
Okay. But you guys have, like, guy... I mean, you in particular, Jerry, have, like, guy movie tastes. Like, I'm
a
guy,
and
I like guy
that's
movies.
Really not true, though.
Well,
and I was really offended by...
But when you list your top 10 movies of the decade or whatever, and 9 of them are about guys doing guy things.
Yeah, but
that's not a
no, Dean. I think you've really, and I was actually, this is actually the problem I have with this whole argument, is that you're obviously not paying attention to the whole history of the show. This is something I do have a bone to pick with you, because we do talk about women and women's movies and actress movies. We do talk about things like Bright Star. We talk about things like Fish Tank. Then we go back and we talk about the great comedies and manners, Garbo, especially the ones with Garbo and we do talk about a lot of these things. Now, yeah, you know why those 10 movies are there? Because I couldn't pick 50. That's why. And let me tell you something. You obviously aren't paying attention to a lot of things today, because I do talk a lot about, we talk about actresses, a lot of great actresses, and not so great actresses. So if you're using that as the criteria, I'm really offended. You think this is an extreme guy-oriented show? It's not.
Well, I do. It is. But
Jamie,
that's the way the movie industry is now.
We're not.
I understand why. You know?
No, but we're not.
We're not
going to
talk about
that's a good.
We're not going to talk about Bachelorette on this show. We're not going to talk about. I mean, we barely talked about Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Well, we talked about Bachelorette. I've talked about Bachelorette. We've talked about. We've talked about Damsels in Distress. All of us at various points. We've talked about a lot of things. I think that's a really. I don't like that you would qualify it as an extreme guy show, because it's just not true. And I think Jamie and Chris have backed me up on this.
Well, I mean, I can't help it that none of us have vaginas. But that doesn't mean.
Yeah, but
that
I mean,
we
do talk a lot about. We've had a lot of actresses that we've interviewed on this show, and we talked a lot about. One of the shows we did a couple of years ago on Gone with the Wind. I mean, you know, very, you know, I would, you know, they're a very female-driven movie.
Molly Haskell. I mean,
Molly Haskell. I mean,
that's like the poster child for, you know, feminism in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a wrong way to categorize a show, and I think a lot of people would disagree with you on that. I was offended by that. Just because we've talked so much.
Okay, so you said that. So you think I'm wrong.
Especially in the indie field. I mean, and we, you know, come on. And since you've been on the show, we talk a lot about Greta Gerwig. And if it's not Greta Gerwig, we talk about Zooey Deschanel. If it's not Zooey Deschanel, we talk about Uma Thurman. If it's not Uma Thurman, we talk about Winona Ryder and all these other actresses that have meant something to us. Penelope Cruz, we've talked about Kate Winslet exclusively on this show because she's been such a powerhouse in the first decade of the 21st century. We talked about Kate Blanchett. Guys who talk about movies like this reject from TBS or something, some horrible TBS-oriented show.
Yeah, but you know what? I mean, we're three men, but we don't sit around talking about Transformers every single show.
Yeah,
I mean, we really don't. Male-driven like that. We don't sit around saying, oh,
no,
let me kick ass and give me a beer or that kind of shit.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really
we're talking
miscategorization
that we don't
of
talk
the show.
I mean, I don't know.
Well,
I mean, you know, I totally understand because really that's just where the industry is right now. It's not. We're not in the 40s anymore. We're not in the 30s anymore. When female dominated stories like sort of just swept over the screen like one after the other all the time. So we're in a time that's extremely like male oriented, and I'm talking about with the surplus of action movies and stuff like that. We really only get around to talking about actresses and so forth. Like, there's not really, you know, all through the summer and even through most of the spring, summer, and half of the fall, It's all just a bunch of action movies, and the only women that are in them are in supporting roles, usually, with very few exceptions, and there's not a lot of female-driven movies out there, you know. So, look, I totally understand
well,
it.
We do, and we don't. There's Anna Karenina, there's the other one, The Royal Affair, there's Farewell, My Queen, the one with Diane Kruger that came out this summer. I mean, we do talk about these. Now, do we give it some of these ones we haven't given a lot of time on the show just because we haven't had time? But
yeah,
but we do, when we see something that's very powerful, like a Fish Tank or a 500 Days of Summer or whatever, we do make a big deal about it. And
you know, quite frankly, I don't see a lot of them because I don't care about women. About movies.
Let's see how much I can inflame
this argument.
Let me give you another few movies that have come out this year that we haven't really talked about at all. I mean, like just you know, we might have talked about it for like 10 minutes and that's it. Margaret, Compliance, Beast of the Southern Wild. We haven't really talked about that a whole lot.
We did talk about
My Sister's Sister. Hold on a second. My Sister's Sister. Deep Blue Sea.
Did I talk about? I've seen all these except for Compliance because that didn't play long enough. But I've seen all these and I didn't see
Compliance. You and I talked about Margaret. Me not liking it and you loving it. I don't know what else you want to say about it other than us to give our opinions on them.
Well, I guess that's true. I mean, there are certain movies that we always go back to and talk about again and again on this show. Well, let me just give you an example: Star Wars or The Godfather. You know,
who doesn't?
None of these
movies are female-oriented movies that we go back to again and again and talk about over and over again. None of them.
I mean,
we talk about every single movie that we see, whether they star women or not. There shouldn't be a fucking quota for the number of movies.
I agree. I mean, that's exactly what I was saying when I said that there are really not that many movies to talk about with women. I truly believe that. I think that there's a dearth of female.
I don't think it's not that there's a dearth, but. I think we don't get around to it. I mean, in any given year, I can give you a lot of films, but here's the thing, James, there's no quota. I've just never looked at our show as a guys sitting around show, guy or I would never think to categorize Movie Geeks United as a guys talking about movies kind of show in that sense of like testosterone driven or however, or just talking about like action movies or what have you.
The other show, The Four Horsemen,
that I used to do, yeah, I would categorize it to an extent like that, but not this show. It never dawned on me to think of that. That's why I was taken aback by what you said a couple of weeks ago.
I'm not saying that we're like, you know, the movie version of The Four Horsemen.
That's not the point. But the way that you made it come across it, we don't, like,
we're not guys who love movies on TBS.
Yeah,
we're not that.
Yeah, I mean,
that's
the point that I got from you, that you were talking about, like, categorizing us like that.
No, we're intelligent commenters on film.
You wouldn't have.
That's exactly why we should embrace this kind of discussion. It's just like, you know, I mean, we should embrace it. You shouldn't look at it as like me trying to insult or me. I'm just saying it's something to look at. That's all. You know, just consider it. That's all. I mean, we don't talk about foreign films on this show quite enough because
no, we don't.
I'm
xenophobic.
That you don't like them.
I think it's time. Dean, I think it comes down to time, though, too, because we could talk. I think all three of us could talk about foreign films that we've seen recently, but it just comes down to the amount of time and whether we've all seen them or whether, you know, it's more than ever, it's easier to see foreign films now with On Demand and with Netflix, Amazon, what have you. But I think it also comes down to time. We just don't have time to, I think, on a weekly basis to go down through all the films we've seen, because it would take longer than 90 minutes or 2 hours, I think.
if we like gave like a sort of like a diary of what we watched this week or something
like
that.
For this week or this month, I mean, I haven't watched as much as I would like to the last couple months, but no, I think I could have, you know, I've seen The Untouchables, I've seen Lola Versus, Safety Not Guaranteed, I think that one, and, you know, a lot of these movies over the summer, and I just didn't talk about them on the show because, A, we didn't come on, or when we did, we talked about the bigger movies, and that's fine. I have no problem with that. I'm not going to, you know, you would have to find a way to bring it up sometimes, but there's just so many on some months that you've seen, it's just like, okay. And I'll be honest with you, I don't remember having seen some of them at the time we do the show. I was like, oh, yeah, I did see that. In a good way, I just don't. But, yeah, I mean, or like, you know, seeing Farewell My Queen or Ruby Sparks or something. Yeah, they all get in there, but I just, sometimes we do focus on the big thing or whatever the big news event is. I mean,
the event is almost always male-driven movies, and I understand it's a trap that we fall into, you know, because we're covering the bigger movies. So you can't deny that, you know, if you look at the top 10 movies this year by box office, that eight of them are going to be almost exclusively male cast.
But there's nothing we can do about that.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not, you know.
So what does that have to do with us?
Well, I mean, if we cover only the bigger movies and don't talk about the smaller ones, then what happens?
But we do
cover
lots
of smaller ones. You cover art films all the time and independent films all the time.
He just got finished saying that there's a lot of movies that fall under the radar because we're talking about
there are fucking 6,000 movies that come out every year.
But He just got finished saying that, yes, we do
I'm
this.
I'm here. You don't have to refer to me in the third person.
Well, you just got finished saying that a lot of movies fall through the cracks because we take a look at the big movies. Well, if we take a look at the big movies over the ones that fall through the cracks, it only stands to reason that most of the big movies that we're going to look at are male-driven movies. I totally get it. I understand. We've got to appeal to people out there who have a chance to see a lot of the movies that we're talking about. And a lot of those movies that fall through the cracks, they don't get to play in Peoria, you know. And so so that's why we don't take a look at them
in a more detailed way.
You know, I mean, I understand. We're not going to sit here and talk about we have a Pope, or we're not going to sit here and talk about Barbara or Hysteria or The Untouchables or any of that stuff.
I think we did talk about Hysteria when that came out.
Yeah, we made jokes about the vibrators.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Yeah, we did.
I mean,
talk about Hysteria.
It's a funny movie, actually.
Yeah.
But and difficult not to make vibrator jokes.
Stars Sad Turtle, right?
Sad Turtle? Who is that?
That's what Maggie Gyllenhaal reminds me of. No,
that's Sad Turtle.
Yeah.
But anyway,
we brought up so many movies. We brought so many movies to people's attention. I mean, we've heard from them a lot. Like, oh, I checked out that movie, or that's on my Netflix, and all this kind of stuff. You know, but we can't talk about all 6,000 movies that come out every year. We just nobody.
About everything
can.
We see, it's hard. It's hard. You got to find a balance.
Yeah.
It isn't all the same film. It's not the same opinions, but it's not all that we've seen different. A lot of different films between all of us. So among all of us.
I think we've got it covered. That's fine.
Yeah.
You know, I think we do a great job on the show. You know, really, it's just a criticism not of the show. Really, it's a criticism of the movie industry. It's what I'm criticizing. I'm not necessarily criticizing the show. I do think that we, you know, touch on everything that's worth touching on. You know, and yes, some things do fall through the cracks, but really, it's the movie industry that deserves a little bit of ire.
And Dean, you know? Like you and I have like broken into tears talking about movies before on this show.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's true.
It isn't that we're not sensitive viewers of movies; that we're so incredibly macho, nothing can reach us.
No.
Yeah, no one's ever made that case on this show.
I mean, I'm told all the time I watch movies like a girl. I'm sure they think that that's a negative thing. But, I mean, if you can't watch a movie with your empathy on, you know, all the way, how can you enjoy it?
Yeah,
I mean, what's
exactly.
The purpose?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, they're creators of emotion is what they're really supposed to be. And it can be any kind of emotion, you know. That's what they do.
Okay, let's try to get off this.
Let's try. Maybe we should wind down for the night.
And we did touch on Beasts of the Southern Wild. Which, why didn't you get into that movie, Jamie? What was it?
Because I didn't watch beyond 15 minutes. You know, the first 15 minutes that you say are so difficult to get through, I didn't get through them. That's why.
Well, I mean, what was it, though? I mean, I gather that. But,
I just
but
watched.
What was
I just watched. I had just watched three movies, and I put that in. And I was like, oh, no, I'm not in this right now. You know.
Uh-huh.
So
well,
I'll go back to it.
It's good. I think you'll dig it. Once you. So my main problem with it was its visual style, and I said, oh, it's going to be one of these shaky cam movies. I don't get it. But you know, I had to embrace it.
Aaron hates
huh?
it. Aaron, our friend Aaron, he doesn't like that movie at all. Okay, so it's time for our next interview. Trip Vinson has produced a series of popular films, including After the Sunset, The Exorcism of Emily Rose, The Number 23, Choke, and Journey to the Center of the Earth. His latest film is also his biggest gamble, Red Dawn, a reboot of the popular 1984 John Milius film starring Patrick Swayze. The film, starring Chris Hemsworth, is now open in theaters everywhere.
Son of a bitch.
What?
The guy sitting behind Cho is Russian.
Are you serious?
The Blue Beret means he's Spetsnaz, Russian Special Forces.
Well, what's his specialty?
Counterinsurgency, for starters.
Are they here because of us?
Well, if they are, they're a little late.
I know this has been a long journey for you. What kind of emotions are you going through right now?
Relief. I'm just relieved, honestly, that the movie's finally coming out. It's been a long, long road.
Yeah. When you produce a film, and you've produced many great ones, is there a sense of closure, or is it always, I would imagine it's always a part of you, but
no,
you...
Not really. I mean, for me at least, I'm sure everybody's different, but I mean, for me, once the movie is released, there's a sense of closure. And one of the things I really, really like about what I do is that, you know, when the movie's released, you get either affirmation for doing good work or you get killed. And, I kind of like that, you know. I like that you make something and you put it out there, and people get to kind of vote. You know, they vote with their dollars whether they enjoyed it or not.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's got to be nerve-wracking because these are your children that you've worked so hard to nurture.
Sure, and you know, of course, it is a little nerve-wracking, but I don't know. I mean, I guess specifically on Red Dawn, I'm a little bit at peace with it. I mean, it's been so many, you know, so many years now of work. If you think about going from development into production, into post-production, the delay we had, then we had to post it again. So it's been, you know, several years. So I'm ready. It's time. I want people to see it and hopefully enjoy it.
So what was the impetus for this reboot? What made you think this can work?
Well, it was really an opportunity. I mean, MGM controlled the rights to Red Dawn, and they were interested in potentially rebooting it, and that seemed like a great opportunity. So we approached them gave them kind of a quick little pitch on how, you know, what we were thinking, some of the changes we would make, and then they said, okay, well, let's go to writers and see if we can get a script. So it was really comes down to just being such a fan of the original movie. It seemed like a great opportunity, and I'm, you know, I'm really glad we pursued it.
Was the when you were thinking on how to update it, the kind of the different international climate today, mm-hmm. you know, the modern kind of face of terrorism in particular. Did that play a role in that?
Well, yeah, I mean, in some ways, I guess it did. I mean, when you're at step one and you're trying to figure out what story you're going to tell, you know, we went through all kinds of different scenarios on who would the bad guys be, what's the impetus for the invasion, and given that it was, you know, I'm going to guess this is about 2007, 2008 when we were in the middle of this, terrorism was, you know, has been on everybody's mind since 2001. So that was something that was, you know, given some thought to, but quickly discarded as there was no way to, you know, make that work. It really proved to be quite a challenge to find a way to create an invasion of the United States. I mean, there just simply aren't that many countries that can pull it off. So we had to take that into account and design the movie around, you know, a plausible way that an invasion would be possible.
Well, in terms of, you know, aside from how you wanted to make your film different, what, you know, Red Dawn, the original film is such a beloved kind of classic of the 80s era, and I'm curious, what do you think the core of that love is, and was it important to maintain that in your version?
Yeah, of course, it was definitely important to maintain that in our version. But it's a good question. I mean, why was Red Dawn so special? I get asked that all the time, right? I think that one of the reasons is the time that it was released. Okay, you can't ignore that it was came out during the Cold War and, you know, played real well on Cold War fears. But when you think about the story, and if you're trying to find a way to retell the story, you have to look for other aspects of the story. Is there something bigger about the story that is actually one of the reasons why it touched so many people?
Mm-hmm.
And we would argue the answer to that question is yes. And the thing that is bigger is this notion of what do you do in this situation? I mean, are you a hero? Will you step up and fight for your family and fight for your neighborhood? You know, there's something very primal about that. And if you can capture that, then I think the story is, you know, universal or timeless, I guess I should say, and would work at any time. And, you know, I was talking to somebody earlier, and if you think about the birth of this country and the people that were here in 1776, I mean, they had to make this decision, and we know what they did. And so my point is that this type of story has existed throughout history many, many, many times, and I think, you know, that makes it something that works whether there's a Cold War or not.
Right. Yeah, it is a very universal kind of theme that we all face in one form or another. I mean, that kind of stepping up into adulthood and those defining moments to kind of define what kind of person you want to be under pressure. Do you have any conversations with Milius?
No. Never spoken to him. And I think he said publicly, I mean, he's not a fan that that we pursued this.
That's surprising. And it's too bad you never spoke to him.
It doesn't surprise me. And to be totally honest, I completely respect his position. I'm not sure how I would feel if somebody, you know, took something that I created and you know, reworked it. I'm not sure I'd be cool with that. So I get where he's coming from and completely, you know, respect his position.
Well, with that film, I mean, there were a cast of young stars that just like blossomed into bigger things in the years that followed, and you're extremely fortunate with the cast that you've assembled here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have some stars that have already exploded, but when you're casting, I mean, for the individual roles, they have to be right for those, but they also have to be right together as an ensemble.
Mm-hmm.
When was it clear to you that they all clicked, that this was a special group?
Well, I mean, during the casting process, you know, it's common to do chemistry reads with actors that will have scenes together. And so, of course, we did that. And we saw, it seemed that the people we cast would be good in the roles and good with each other. But it really wasn't until we started rehearsals and training that that you know. And, you know, we put our cast through a pretty rigorous military training program. And that's a great way to get the cast to bond and get to know each other and learn to trust each other. And inevitably, if you have those things working for you, you usually get pretty good performances.
Mm-hmm. Well, this I know that this movie, your film has... when was the production complete on it?
The production wrapped at the end of 2009.
Okay. So this has been a long road, and I guess it was kind of, it was stalled by bankruptcy of MGM?
Yes, yes. Wow. MGM went into bankruptcy.
Was it difficult to keep the faith in these years?
In some ways it was, but in other ways it wasn't. I mean, I felt that we had something pretty good here, and I felt confident that what we had aspired and set out to do, we had achieved. Whether the audience agrees with me, by the way, or not, that's yet to be seen. But at least what we tried to make was made the way we wanted it to be made. But yeah, certainly. I mean, when you're facing those types of challenges that are much bigger than you. And you have a big company, they're going through a bankruptcy, the future's uncertain, you know, yeah, it is hard. And it became harder, frankly, once they emerged from bankruptcy and no longer had distribution and had to find somebody else to distribute the movie. And, you know, the movie was very politically sensitive to a lot of these other distributors, and thus we had to make some changes to it.
Have you had an opportunity to see how your film plays with an audience?
Yes. I mean, I tested it once.
Okay. So
we've had some promotional screenings since then. So yeah, I mean, I've seen it play with an audience.
And how fulfilling is that? I mean, because I think about that. If this is my baby and I'm unveiling it to an audience for the first time. I think I would not be able to sit still.
It's a nerve-wracking experience. I mean, because at the end of the day, the only reason you're making these movies is for them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course you put a lot of hard work and blood, sweat, and tears and, you know, God knows, you know, emotion and everything else into this. But it's all for nothing if it doesn't work, if the audience doesn't respond to it. So, yeah, that is pretty nerve-wracking. But luckily with this movie... you know, the audiences I've shown it to or seen it with have responded fantastically. So it's been very rewarding in that sense. We had a premiere type event up in Port Hueneme at a naval base last week, and seeing this movie with those folks was really special.
Oh, I would imagine that had to be gratifying. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you look at the material. I mean, what, because you've done films in all kinds of genres, what does it have to do for you? How does it have to pull you in?
Oh, man, I don't know how to answer that. I mean, material stories either speak to you or they don't, you know. So I guess it's just kind of a gut kind of feeling. I don't know that I have a better answer for it than that.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes things come along and, you know, the challenge of making it is something that you consider. I mean, I seem to be really drawn to action movies, and I think it's not just because I like the genre so much, but also because I like how complicated and tough they are to make. And there's so many elements that go into a good action movie. I mean, you know, all the normal things, how it's shot and, you know, the actors and, you know, who your director is and all that, of course, but sound and music and many, many, many things. And I don't know, there's part of me, I guess, that gets off on how complex that genre is to make.
Yeah. And you've made, I mean, I love so many of your films. And I do think they're so diverse, But when you look back and you think of the movies that shaped you in your life, what are one or two titles that you look at and you say, man, if I make something that approaches that, I can die a happy man?
I'm going to answer the question maybe a little differently. I mean, I thought what you were going to ask me was what are the movies that you love the most, or what are the biggest influences? Of course, if I ever made either of these movies, I'd die a happy man, but I don't presume to be able to have the genius of George Lucas or Steven Spielberg. So I would answer Star Wars and Raiders. I mean, I grew up in the 80s, and those movies changed my life. Those are the reasons. You know, those are the reasons why I got into the movie business. It's guys like that and Jim Cameron and, you know, those movies from the 80s really had a big impact on me.
Yeah, well, yeah, and I'm probably your same age group, so definitely me too. Do you think that since that time, do you think that the audiences have changed at all? Do you think there's a cynicism, or is there still kind of an open, magical kind of feeling amongst the audiences of today?
Oh, I think there's definitely a magical feeling amongst the audiences today. I mean, look at what Pixar does today.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, those movies, okay, you could say, well, they're kids' movies, but I know lots of adults that go see those movies, and, you know, I'll include myself in that, and I think it's because of their ability to create magic on screen.
That's it for this episode of Movie Geeks United. Thank you for joining us. Good night.